Hi, everybody. We're going to call this meeting to order, the Energy, Finance, and Policy Committee. And we do have a quorum. Looks like everybody's here. We have a full table today, which is great. Nice job. Oh, maybe we're missing Dave. He'll be here. So today is the first day of the 2026 session for the Energy Committee, and we do have some new members, and so I think it might be helpful if we take just a minute and do some brief introductions for members and staff and pages. So maybe with that we can start with Mr. Wiener, or Representative Wiener, would you like to start? We can work our way around the table.
I'm getting to it. Calm down. I know this is the first committee, and we're all excited, but we'll get there. I'm State Representative Mike Wiener. I represent District 5B, which is in the center part of the state, and this is my second term.
Just go around the table.
Representative Shane Mecklen, represent 27A, which is Becker Big Lake, and this is my fourth term.
Representative Tom Sexton, I'm a freshman, although the white hair would say otherwise. I represent Waseca, Owatonna, and Medford. I call it the Cabela's District. They just changed the name to Bass Pro Shop. So if you're driving 35 south towards Iowa, you're coming through the district. So glad to be here. I'm also a veteran.
Representative Spencer Igo, representing House District 7A, about half of Minnesota's Iron Range. This is my third term.
Hi, I'm Paul Anderson. I'm a farmer. Live up in western Minnesota. Represent parts or most of five counties. And good to be here.
I'm Tom Murphy. So District 9B, so the western part of Douglas and the eastern part of Otter Tail counties. And so I've been in my own business for 34 years, and this is my second term.
Mark Nicely, House Republican Caucus staff. I've spent a couple stints with the Energy Committee as Minority Research. This is my first year as a committee administrator. I also work with Chair Anderson on the Ag Committee.
Chris Wozinski, State Rep 15A, down in southwest Minnesota on the first defense when South Dakota attacks.
Hi, everybody. Representative Patty Akam. This is my fourth term on Energy.
Co-chairs, members, Mike Molzon, DFL, committee administrator.
Bob Euliff with the House Research Department. I've been with the Energy Committee since 2004.
I'm Ashley Yang. I'm House Fiscal Staff. I track the committee budget and request and present fiscal notes.
Larry Kraft, second term, represent 46A, St. Louis Park.
I'm Megan Grinicolai. I'm kind of an Uber freshman. I am from St. Paul, just about 4 miles away from here in 64A.
I'm a WAB. Hello, my relatives. I'm Shelley Buck. Meg and I had the same election day and the same swearing in. We're the newbies. So I represent 47A, which is South Maplewood and Woodbury.
Representative Ned Carroll, this is my second term. And what about white hair, Tom? This is red hair. It's just, this is what happens to it. That's why I grow the beard, so you see that I have red. So anyway, it's my second term. Represent Plymouth and west side of Plymouth, and one precinct in Maple Grove.
Hi, everybody. My name is Athena Hollins. I represent the northern neighborhoods of St. Paul, 66B. And this is my third term and my third term on energy.
Hi, I'm Representative Katie Jones, represent 61A, which is downtown southwest and a little bit of North Minneapolis.
Hello, everyone. My name is Anna Mahmoud. I represent South Minneapolis, and this is my first term.
We're going to come back to Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and again, welcome to the new members. I'm looking forward to meeting you both. Dave Baker, I'm from the western part of the state here, Candiota County. This is my 12th year. I'm also the co-chair of workforce and proud to be on energy. Thank you.
And then maybe we can have staff stand, Eric and Andrew. And then we do also have a couple of pages, Ben, I think.
Hi, Ben Lewis, committee page.
And Shelby. Great. Well, welcome, everybody. Well, I'm glad to be here and glad to have the Department of Commerce here to start us off today to give us a little update and hear what they're hearing from some of the things going on in Washington. So with that, I'll turn it over to, I guess we're going to Pete Wyckoff, or Commissioner Wyckoff first, please.
Thank you, Chair Ekum. I'm very glad to be here. It's good to see you all again. Look forward to a conversation that will stretch over the next 3 months and hopefully no longer than that. I'm Pete Wyckoff. I'm Deputy Commissioner for Minnesota Department of Commerce. I run the Energy Division. And I'm having trouble with slides. I'm going to go on for a little over 20 minutes, and I blame Mike Molzon and the fact I used to be a college professor out in Morris, Minnesota. So I will have very interesting things to say with that background. Just as a reminder, I know it's the second year in biennium, so you all know who we are, but we are the Division of Energy Resources. I'm Deputy Commissioner Pete Wyckoff. I'm over both sides of the division, or DER, as we affectionately call it. And two sides of the shop with me today is Assistant Commissioner Alyssa Polish, who runs our federal and state initiatives side of DER. That is focused at towards Washington, D.C. and towards this capital here, and is in charge of programs and policies. We have two offices there, Energy Affordability, that biggest programs they run are the Federal Energy Assistance Program and the Federal Weatherization Program, which has a state supplement. The energy development side of Assistant Commissioner Polish's part of the shop focuses on non-residential programs, has what I call our energy think tank, which is willing to provide technical assistance to anyone who wants to talk about energy, and we keep a lot of data on the Minnesota energy system. We also have moved energy reliability and security over into that part of the shop just in the last year. The other side is regulatory affairs. It's run by Dr. Sydney Lieb. She's over at the PUC right now, which is where you normally find her on a Thursday. The way I kind of describe it is our sister agency, the PUC, the Public Utilities Commission, you'll hear from them later, is the judge or a group of judges, and we are state's attorney at the PUC. And together we work to implement state policy and regulate the regulated investor-owned for-profit utilities in the gas sector and in the electric sector. We tell them what to think, and then sometimes they listen to us. That's pretty much how it works. The regulatory side also runs our utility energy conservation programs with consultation from the PUC, but we are more directly in charge. That's the SIP Eco program that you all, in a bipartisan manner, created a few years ago. We do telecommunications, but not cool telecommunications. We don't do your cell phones. We do your landlines. We are active in regional and federal regulatory advocacy, and we do, thanks to the permitting bill that you all passed 2 years ago, advocacy in the energy infrastructure permitting space. So that's who we are. I want to set up today sort of a intro to where the state of the energy system is in Minnesota and nationally, because it will relate to a lot of the things we'll be talking about over the next 3 months. I read the PUC presentation, and some of this will be repeat when they get to it. I'm glad that they don't seem to contradict us, so that seems like a good thing. If you hear the same things twice, maybe it's true. One of the things that's been in the news is that electric demand in the country, and we're going to start to see this in Minnesota too, has been or seems to be increasing. That's after a long period of stagnation, where new economic activity using electricity was balanced out by increases in efficiency. We may be entering a different era in 2025, 2026. We are starting to see load growth again, and that changes how we think about the electric system. What is driving that? It's new uses for electricity like heat pumps and electric vehicles, and then the big sexy thing everybody's talking about, mega users of electricity like data centers. We'll see how that goes. The gas system has followed a very similar pattern. neither us nor the PUC has a whole lot to do with the gasoline system, except for we keep data on that at the Department of Commerce on Assistant Commissioner Polish's side of the shop. But one of the interesting things to note on the left side here, from my perspective, your left too, I think, it shows U.S. gasoline use, which actually has been going down. That's mostly because of efficiency and a little bit of adoption of EVs. But on the right, and this gets back to the electric system, I want to point out, because I don't think most Americans realize this, how fast the car and light-duty vehicle system is changing in the world. Globally, car sales peaked in 2017, and they have fallen off a cliff. And by car sales, I mean old-fashioned internal combustion engine car sales. They did fall off because of COVID total car sales, but what you're seeing there in black is the rapid decline in internal combustion engine cars globally, being replaced by variations on electric. That brings it into our realm as we are thinking about what's happening going forward. Bloomberg New Energy Finance has models. Everybody has models. All models are wrong. Some are useful. Is the phrase I like to say, that says we can expect near-term electricity demand in the U.S. to increase. This is 2025 predicted out. And the yellow there is buildings. The blue there are data centers. And notice those are the big drivers in the near term. But if we follow that global pattern, which we probably will despite Washington's changes in policy, we can expect EVs to be a huge driver of demand in the coming decades. So demand is likely going up. I want to now look into, in that context, what are the drivers of energy costs? Because I know that everybody here wants to talk about energy affordability. And then in the last part, I'm going to go into the impact likely of costs of changes at the federal level we've seen in the last year. In late 2025, the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab released a study. And usually that is not something that any normal person notices. But this study made a lot of press. And it was looking at what are the drivers and what are the trends in prices in the electric sector nationally. They were mostly focused on 2019 to 2024. My team has talked with the authors of this, and I'm sure they'd be glad to come in and talk to you all. The first thing I'll point out from the study is, and I think this goes against how people have been thinking about electricity, in terms of inflation-adjusted prices, and this is nationally, or in terms of GDP, or in terms of percent of personal family consumption, the cost of electricity has been doing nothing but going down. That is presumably good news, but that is not helpful if you are one of the families that are energy burdened, so I don't want to forget that. The map on the right shows energy burden for Minnesota counties. You'll notice the darker counties, those are the ones with the highest energy burden. There are entire counties in Minnesota where the average energy burden is over 7% of disposable income. That is driven mostly by places that still heat with fuel oil or propane. Those are far and away the most expensive ways to heat your home. But all over Minnesota, we find families that struggle with energy prices. I think this very same graph is in the next presentation. This is also from that same study, and this is homing in on the 2019 to 2024 period. Minnesota, you see there, and that light color means we've had inflation adjusted over that five-year period, actual decline in electricity prices in Minnesota from 2019 to 2024. It gets more interesting when you break down and start to look at what forces are driving prices up and what forces are driving them down, because the actual price is the balance of those things. The way I like to think about the electricity systems, you can divide it into pieces, and this is the way we think about in the regulatory work world too. There's generation. Your electricity has to come from someplace. And in the old school, it often came from very far away. So you have generators. Generators have expenses. Those are their capital expenses of building the generator, the power plant of whatever kind, and those are the operating expenses, which is mostly fuel costs. And the good news in the electric sector is that the cost of generation has been plummeting. The cost of generation has been plummeting because we have moved away from coal. The peak of generation cost in the U.S. was 2009, which is also the peak of U.S. coal use. Since then, the switch to gas, which is generally cheaper, though not in a winter storm, than coal, and the switch to wind and solar, which have no fuel costs, have led to tremendous declines in the cost of electricity generation. And we expect those patterns to continue, and the Minnesota 2040 law is riding that wave. We're riding the wave to clean. It's also riding the wave to affordable. You generate someplace, then you have these big high voltage lines that take them from the someplace, if the someplace is not near the demand, to where the demand for the electricity is. And those big high voltage lines are called transmission lines. We are starting to actually pay more, not less, for transmission. And then you want the electricity to go to your house. So you need a low voltage line that distributes it around your neighborhood, around your city, around your town. That's called the distribution system. That is actually the biggest driver of cost increases, what's happening in that. And as a regulator, that's kind of scary because I know what a transmission line should cost. I know what a coal plant should cost. It's hard to tell what the black box of a distribution system could cost because it's thousands of nodes. It's thousands of transformers. It's thousands of things that we are going to need as we move forward to start delving deeper and deeper into what's happening in that distribution system. And we're going to need to work with our PUC to make the utilities show us what's inside the black box. This is another way of looking at it. In the last 5 years, distribution system inflation has been where we've seen the big driver up. Again, prices didn't increase on the national level because there were other things driving down. But if it had just been distribution cost, inflation would have been real. This is Minnesota specific. This is Excel. We have a distribution planning process, which is separate right now from our generation planning process, which is separate from our transmission process. Commerce feels like they should all be merged into one, but that's a different conversation. Excel is showing that national pattern of increased, dramatically increased distribution costs. One thing I want to point out is the yellow there. The yellow there is climate change. The yellow there is increasing wildfire risk. If you look at the places that have seen major inflation in electricity in the U.S., those are the places that burn, and those are the places that get hurricanes. Excel is saying we need to spend a lot more on wildfire protection in Excel territory in Minnesota. It is our job as regulators to say, is that the right amount? We need insight into what's going on there. I don't want to just pick on Excel. This is 2020 to 2029, part of that distribution planning process. Minnesota Power's making the same case that their costs are skyrocketing in the distribution black box. Interestingly, there's a third utility, which is a cooperative utility, which has a different economic incentive structure and a different structure. I don't want to make too much of one data point. But our co-op utility that comes in for distribution planning is not seeing that huge increase in asked for distribution expenses. Skipping out of the national lab study for a second, looking at the gas system, just to say this case is mostly the same. What this shows is 2018 to 2025. One thing that's interesting in the gas system, this is the gas to your house to heat your house. Residential rates nationally just kind of keep going up. The cost of the actual gas doesn't keep going up. It fluctuates. just like the distribution and transmission systems are more of the cost of the electric system now, in gas, it used to be the cost of the gas was about half of your bill. Now the cost of the gas is about 30% of your bill. This is a system that is getting more and more expensive to maintain and build out from a capital point of view. Back to electricity. This is back to the 2019 to 2024 study. If you look at what happens to electric systems when there is severe weather or when there is a disruption in the gas market like the Russian invasion of Ukraine, electric systems are actually, because of their increased gas dependence, more susceptible than they used to be to price fluctuations along with natural gas. Here we see the states assorted by increased gas exposure, and the y-axis here is cost, and we see the spike you get when you have more gas exposure, at least during that period after the Ukraine war. Better news is if you don't have fuel costs during that same time period, 1909 to 24, if you were adding more wind and solar, your costs were going down. That's what this regression line, or the implied regression line, shows. There are other ways to look at this, and they all show basically the same thing. This will be something we talk about a lot in the context eventually of EV adoption and other things like that, but mostly people are talking about it in the context of data centers, which are a really unique challenge or a new challenge. If you spread EVs across your state, there's an increased load all over the place. If you build a data center, it's an increased demand for electricity at a very specific place. That can be very interesting. But the good news is that if done right, increases in load drive down your costs. And here's the basic theory. Increases in load take a system that is built for the peak demand, but is normally running way under the peak demand, and pushes up to take advantage of that unused capacity. And when you do that, you're spreading those fixed costs of the system over more customers, or you're taking this giant customer and saying, you pick up a big part of the charge. That's the dream of getting electric growth that works right and drives down costs. That was all 2019 to 24, and that study got a lot of press. This is a 2025 study, and the story started to change last year, maybe. 1 year does not necessarily make a trend. But the story you all saw last year was, oh my gosh, utility bills are rising. Electricity is going through the roof. That's a 2025 story. What would be the drivers of that? To the extent there's some extent that it is very much true. The same drivers we saw before, the need to replace aging infrastructure, particularly aging infrastructure that's subjected to new extreme weathers. That's the biggest driver. Volatile fuel costs, and when I say volatile fuel costs, read that as gas. Coal isn't that volatile. Wind and solar are free. And increased demand for electricity, because we started to see places when new big sources demand for electricity started to come in. They went to the places with a lot of headspace. But now we're spreading out to places that don't have a lot of headspace. So then you're actually driving up peak demand. We have, thanks to you all, passed a data center package, which is really a large load package, that is hopefully going to make sure that when we attract these large loads to Minnesota, the added costs are attributed to the cost makers. But I just wanted to say, what is the danger that we're trying to avoid there? We want to get the benefits of we're bringing in large loads, they are paying for themselves, or they're just increasing capacity. That's good. We want to protect ourselves from bringing large loads. Either they drive up peak and they don't pay for it. That's bad. That drives up rates. Or even more scary, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure there'll be data center hearings. They come in and then they go away. if the demand is transient before the infrastructure is paid off, then you have a big problem. Hopefully we have in Minnesota, thanks to your work, the right procedures to guard against both of those scenarios. Back to this, things are going up. They are. Nationally, energy last year drove inflation as opposed to lagging and bringing down inflation. The biggest was in natural gas. The second biggest was in electricity. In Minnesota, we're starting to see rate cases come in. When fuel costs go up, that just automatically gets transferred through, basically. But automatic rate increases don't happen in a world with PUCs and commerce there to watch. So we're seeing pressures, but we don't know how that's going to resolve here in Minnesota. I want to turn to what we've seen in terms of inflationary pressure coming out of the federal government in the last year.
Well, thank you, Professor Wyckoff. Are you passing off to,
No, I'm keeping going.
Glasses on? I thought we were changing speakers here. No, my apologies for interrupting.
I just every once in a while like to try to look at you versus looking at the paper.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear it. My apologies for interrupting. He needed to take a drink.
Thanks. All right.
Please continue.
This hasn't impacted us yet, but we do expect it will going forward. In the middle of last year, Congress and then the President signed into law terminating clean energy tax credits for some cases. The biggest issue was the termination going forward of commercial scale wind and solar tax credits. It's a complicated thing. There are two deadlines coming up, so we'll see how many projects make it before they hit either deadline. There's something called commence construction, where if you're building a big facility, you can start by July 2026, and then you have 4 years to finish it. Or you can say, I didn't make that deadline, but I just finished it by the end of 2027, and you can still get these tax credits. That's for bigger projects. Household clean energy and EV credits were terminated in 2025. From the terminated credits, which gets more complicated because there's new rules about foreign ownership, and it just gets complicated, and my partner here can dive into the details if you have questions. We did a calculation that there's about $7 billion in tax credits in approved IRPs for Xcel, Minnesota Power, and Otter Tail Power that are at risk. Those are things that were supposed to be built between 2028 and 2032. Now there's a move to try to push some of those up, so we might not lose all of that, but we're gonna build those anyway, and I'll get to why in a second. But that means that that money that would have been picked up by federal taxpayers will now be paid by Minnesota ratepayers to a state that gives way more to the federal coffers than we take back. So, nevertheless, wind and solar are still going to be the cheapest way to build out new generation capacity. We will just pay for more of it. Why is that? It's not only they're going to be cheaper, it's what we can build. If you look at supply chains and what can happen quickly, we can build wind and solar with storage quickly. There's a lot of talk about nuclear, and I'm very personally pro-nuclear, and my boss, the governor, has a complicated, we'll talk about it, I'm sure, thoughts on this. There's a push to restart mothball nuclear plants. Those will start to come online, a grand total of three nationally, in the 2027 to 2030, and then that will probably be about it. Maybe we'll get some more mothballed restarted, but it takes a while. There are natural gas supply chain issues that are extremely severe. So if you decide today you want to build a natural gas plant that you hadn't already ordered the generators for, you're not getting it this decade. You could build wind and solar this decade. You can't build gas if you hadn't planned on it. And if you want to talk about the next generation nuclear, that's even farther off. So what we can build in the face of rising demand is wind and solar, and that's just about it. If we want to do things even quicker, we can do things like energy efficiency, demand response, virtual power plants, grid-enhancing technologies, and power line reconductoring. I hope we talk a lot about those things in the next 3 months because those are cheap, those are good use of resources, and those are things we're going to need to push, at least on the IOUs, because it's not in their best interest to do it. The co-ops and the munis are in a different place. They'll do it anyway, and they are leading the charge. The impact of these lots of tax credits, it's hard to tell because we don't know how many projects are going to be able to get through the new deadlines. We don't know how the new rules are going to work. But I'll just throw out one model done by a conservative group that suggested this would drive up rates in Minnesota about 10% over the next 3 years. That's a driving up force. Remember, we're talking about the balance of driving up and down forces. Something else could amplify that and could be much worse, or something else could cancel it out. So I'm not saying this is what's going to happen. I'm saying all other things kept equal, that's what we would expect from the loss of the tax credits. I just want to mention one other tax credit that doesn't sound like electricity but is. There was a tax credit called the Clean Hydrogen Production Tax Credit that is going to be terminated in 27. That is where you take clean electricity and you turn it into hydrogen. There were a lot of things that Minnesota planned out in the western part of the state, like making green ammonia and green fertilizer, that don't make economic sense if you take away that tax credit, which is going away. That industry is going to get nipped in the bud. Up on the range, we have a long history of taking our iron ore, which is oxidized and needs to be reduced with something. The something has always been coal. We could have brought the coal to Minnesota historically and done the steel in Minnesota. Instead, we took our iron ore and we sent it to where the coal was, and the steel is made in Gary and in other places that aren't Minnesota, so I don't care about them, all right? The promise of green hydrogen and other technologies like that is there's no reason to ship the iron ore to the coal anymore. So you can move high up the value chain with Minnesota iron. But without that tax credit, it's not going to be competitive. At Commerce, we have responded to the impending loss of these tax credits by pushing folks with incentives to take advantage of them as quickly as possible. We launched a solar on public buildings for non-Xcel territory project in the second half of last year. We didn't know what the uptake would be. We've funded 199 projects all over Minnesota. Every part of Minnesota wanted in on this action, and there will be, I guarantee, in your district almost, I don't know, you can look on the map, projects coming from this get the tax credits while they're there project we launched in Department of Commerce. There are some tax credits that are extending, including the geothermal tax credits. I assume there will be a lot of talk over the next years about how can we take advantage of that in Minnesota. You all funded a geothermal planting grant round, and we had a lot of interest in that from all over Minnesota, and those studies and that money that are out in the field right now. The biggest deal is going to be the tax credits, because that's where the money was from the feds. But there were also billions of dollars in grants, and we were very successful in Minnesota in bringing those grants to the state enterprise and more broadly to our utilities, to our universities, to our tribes. Those grants, even though they were signed contracts, and we talked about this last year, were something that the federal government under the new administration decided to go after. And they have successfully, because it costs a lot to go to court, canceled grants, I think illegally, to many NGOs, many companies, many universities, and many tribes in Minnesota. Excel's here. We can talk about the latest on the on the Excel grants. Thanks to legal action through our attorney general and other attorney generals, most of the grants to the state enterprise, which is what we can sue over, are still going forward, at least in theory. In practice, a lot of them are held up by ongoing legal battles, and even more frustrating, the legal battles are resolved, but the sign-offs just don't come. And that may be because there's no one left working in that office at the Department of Energy, or maybe one or two where there used to be 10. It may not be nefarious, and it may just be they can't get to it. I was pleased that Congress rejected proposed cuts in the recent budget deal to the federal low-income energy assistance programs and the weatherization assistance programs. I thank you all who lobbied for that. There are other inflationary actions that have been taken. One of them is the, we think, and we are in a lawsuit around this, illegal federal overstretch by the federal government telling coal plants that are scheduled to come offline, who are not needed for reliability, and who are too costly, which is why they were going offline, to stay online. The first of these was a consumer's utility, energy, that's a utility in Michigan owned plant that was ordered to stay open even though MISO, our regional balancing authority, said we don't need it. The utility said they don't need it. The Michigan PUC says we don't need it. It's too expensive. Let's get rid of it. It's still open. It is estimated to cost $300 million annually to keep that barely runs at all coal plant online. And the part that cheeses me is Minnesota ratepayers are paying for it because everybody in northern MISO is paying for that coal plant to stay online. Other plants followed suit, including at the end of the year in Colorado and in Washington State. And we are watching what happens as one of the units of Sherco is scheduled to come offline this year, and we anticipate this will be something that we fight about. If we are unsuccessful and it stays open, it will cost ratepayers. So I'm wrapping up, I promise. A march through the federal actions, all of which are inflationary in the energy space. The repeal of the clean energy tax credits. The failed to deliver on duly signed contracts for energy-related grants. Tariffs, which I didn't talk about, but have interrupted the supply chains and been targeted at clean energy components. These policies to stop plant closures. And finally, policies that are increasing exports of natural gas. For a long time, the U.S. was benefiting from having the cheapest natural gas in the world. There wasn't really an international gas market. If you had it, you had it, and it was cheap, and your industries benefited from it, and your people who heated their houses benefited from it. That is dramatically changing because of policies coming out of Washington that says we should export that stuff, and we should have an international price of gas, not an American cheap price of gas. And our own government, the current administration, is saying that is going to drive up prices. We can expect our natural gas bills to heat our house and drive our electricity to go up. Per the Energy Information Administration, the Trump administration, we expect prices on average to be 16% higher in 2026 than in 2025, primarily due to increased liquefied natural gas exports. January 2026 forecasts say they expect an additional, for the same reason, 12 to 13% hike in gas costs because of these exports. This is not about temporary price spikes for weather events. This is about a fundamental change in the way the market works, and we have given away our competitive advantage. Minnesota has a 2040, 100% by 2040, law. Energy demand is expected for electricity to increase in Minnesota due to data centers and electrification, and that can be good. This is why they want to come to Minnesota, is because we are going to give them clean electrons. HR 1 makes that energy more expensive, but solar and wind will remain the easiest and most cost-effective to build until we get to the last piece, where we might need nuclear plants, where we might need something else. The 2040 drive that we are currently on is a drive to cheaper electricity as well as cleaner electricity. Despite these changes, we are still on track to meet. As I showed last year, modeling studies, and we have a much more comprehensive modeling study on the field now by the Department of Commerce of what would happen and what are the cheapest ways to 2040 goals, show a huge build out in solar and wind with their no fuel costs, driving in a cost-effective way compliance with Minnesota 2040. There's a lot there to unpack, and I'm not going to do it again. But I remember last time being frustrated, but we spent a lot of time talking about oh my gosh, we can't do solar and wind, they take up too much space. So I asked my team, as a final slide, to calculate how much solar we would need in Minnesota to meet the 2040 target. On the left side, we see that yellow dot in the middle. That is the current solar distribution in Minnesota. On the right side, we see a bigger yellow dot, but still not that big, which is the 2040 solar build-out. We can do it on roofs. We can do it on low-value agricultural land, but we have the room.
Well, thank you. That was a lot. I think that last picture is pretty telling. That says a lot. So we're going to turn to member questions. But before we do that, I'm going to take privilege of asking a quick one, and that's in terms of the coal plants that are being extended. I think you referred to a $300 million cost annually, and that covers all of MISO. About what? How much of that for Minnesota?
We can get you the Minnesota breakdown, and I can ask Mike Bull if he's whispering to me. He could just say it out loud. 14% of that is to Minnesota.
So you're going to make me do the math? I can do the math.
About $42 million.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And with that, I think Representative Carroll was first on the list.
Thank you, Chair. This is a great presentation, a lot to think about, a lot to digest. One of your energy drivers was replacing aging infrastructure. Could you talk about that and how much it's costing or will cost?
Mr. Wyckoff.
So there is just a problem that a lot of what we've built, for instance, I know in my head that the two nuclear plants in Minnesota are older than me. And I'm not young. and we have other generation facilities that have been around just a heck of a lot of time. I mean, they get constantly updated, but at some point you want to build new. But also all the wires and the things you don't think about, the transformers. Those need to be replaced on a regular cycle, like a lot of things in infrastructure, like roads and bridges. We probably haven't been doing it as aggressively as we should. And now the bill comes due as things get old in the end of their useful age. We in commerce, especially on the distribution side, are starting to think about what is legit there. What is it needs to be replaced? What is being replaced not because it's reached the end of its useful life, but because the capacity constraints of that infrastructure is being pushed? And are the things we can do to increase the capacity of that existing but not at the end of its useful life infrastructure that would save us a lot of money? So we're trying to get into the details of what's out there. And I know I'm not answering your question with a number because I don't have one, but it is a big part of no matter what, we would have lots of capital costs for the energy electric sector and for the gas sector because they have not gotten the maintenance that they needed for years and years and years and years.
Okay, quick follow-up. So whose responsibility is that, the utilities or the state?
I'm not saying that they're unsafe.
No. Right. Whose responsibility for the cost?
Commissioner Wyckoff.
So, not doing this right. Chair Aitken, Representative, sorry.
Sorry.
Getting back into that.
We're all getting back into the rhythm.
So, you know, if you get your electricity from a co-op or a muni, you basically own the company. It's your co-op or muni on your behalf that is charging all of the costs of this directly to you. It's a little more complex for these investor-owned utilities, but in the end, most of it gets charged to ratepayers. They have the responsibility for paying the costs. It is the responsibility of the regulators in those cases working with the companies to decide what is an appropriate capital expense for maintenance and upgrades and what is an inappropriate expense.
Representative Carroll? No, you're good. Okay. On to Representative Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Wyckoff. I have a number of questions. First, did I hear you right? So you had mentioned something about combining the transmission, distribution, and IRP planning. Can you say more about that,
so,
Commissioner?
Chair, I come. Representative. We're not coming forth with a bill proposal, but eventually, and I think everybody agrees here. Right now, if you consider these things independently, there are probably solutions that are the least cost solution or the ideal solutions where you shouldn't be modeling your transmission separately from your distribution system, separately from your generation where you place it. I'm proud of the fact and happy of the fact Minnesota is trying to do all three and is sort of a national leader on planning for all three parts of the system, but it's not like it's ideal here. Moving forward, and this study we are commissioning at Commerce, we want to say, aren't there synergies you can have by doing joint planning across all three aspects of the system that might not appear and emerge if you do it one at a time?
Representative Jones.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. That's intriguing. Curious to learn more about that as you develop that further. Speaking of distribution, on slide 13, you had pointed out the difference between the IOU's distribution CapEx increases versus the co-op, and obviously you mentioned there was just one data point there. But do you have any ideas as to, not just the incentive structure that's slightly different, but are we worried at all that the co-op is maybe just underinvesting, or what might be going on there? Commissioner Wyckoff.
So I'm going to, Chair Ickham, representative, I'm also going to say something and then pass it to my compatriot here, whose staff is doing a lot of thinking on this. If you think of the incentive structures, co-ops, God bless them, they have to pay for everything. maybe they don't make the right decision, but they make the decision that they want to make about it. Everything's a trade-off. Like, my staff has been digging in, and this is kind of crazy, and she's probably about to kick me, but and saying, all right, how many outages can we tolerate? If you tolerate an outage of this length and this number in a year versus slightly more, the cost can be incredibly different. So there's trade-offs that you're going to make. And I'm not suggesting an answer, but I am suggesting the truth is, if you have a zero outage tolerance, let's say, you're going to pay through the teeth for that, and most of the payment is for the last bit. So co-ops and IOUs and munis, the co-ops and the munis versus the IOUs have different incentive structures, may come to different answers, but I'm not saying that that is necessarily mean they're coming to the wrong answer, but I am saying that it is our job, since we have given a for-profit company, to work with the PUC to say, we have to understand what you're asking for here and independently verify that it is the right thing, because you're going to get a profit off of it. No one's making a profit off of anything on the co-op and muni side.
And no more to add. Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. That's really interesting. I mean, that just makes me think about, are there safeguards that we might want to consider as a body for munis and co-ops going forward? Don't need to look into that more later, we can talk about it later. But, I'll make this my last question. I'm just going to get out two questions, and then you can answer both. The first one is on slide 23. You had mentioned ways to deploy being able to meet our energy needs and deploying energy efficiency, demand response, that whole list will help with that. But you also said that it's not in IOU's best interest to do that. Do you have suggestions on how to push our co-ops and munis leading the way, and are there examples about it? So I guess those are all my questions. Commissioner.
Chair. Representative, you asked two questions. I'm only going to do that once, right? Okay. All right. For instance, if I'm an IOU and I install equipment that allows me to get more out of a transmission line. And it means I don't build another new transmission line. I've lost a lot of money in that deal. If I'm a co-op, where I would have to pay all of that transmission line, there's no profits to be made. I'm really incentivized to say, oh, you have a way that I can get more out of the current transmission line? I'm really interested in that. And an IOU doesn't have that same interest. Doesn't mean they're evil. It just means that's the way that's set up, and it means we regulators have to be riding them to say, look, you're going to have to build a lot of transmission. Don't worry. We need a lot more transmission. But we also need to take advantage of the things we already have, because if we have lines that could be cheaply upgraded to carry more power, that's what the ratepayer is owed. And that is something we are going to have to work very closely with our sister agency to make sure it happens. And it may require more legislation from you all.
I just want to keep us on track here. We've got about 10-ish minutes. We've got three people on the list, and we'll maybe just have to have Professor Wyckoff back. But next on the list is Representative Crafton, if you can be as brief as possible.
Got it. Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioner. On the coal thing, that $300 million was one coal plant. Do we know how many other coal plants are in the MISO territory that could be subject to this? Seems like cost, jiu-jitsu.
Commissioner Wyckoff.
Chair Acom, Representative, I don't have that number with me, but we can get it to you. The known retirement dates for most coal plants are out there, or expected retirement dates and where they are. So if none of them retired, there have been studies nationally, it's in the billions, if none of them retired, that the extra cost would be per year. But I don't have a MISO specific number, but we can get that.
Okay. Great. Yeah, we'd love to hear that. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioner. You talked about the green hydrogen tax credit, right? And how that could unlock some really potentially exciting new economic opportunities for Minnesota. One question might be, well, you know, why do you need a tax credit for this thing? If it's needing that to become an opportunity. But maybe could you comment on that and maybe where it is in its technology life cycle and why that might, I'm leading you a little bit, why that kind of tax credit might make sense right now?
Commissioner Wyckoff.
Chair Acom, Representative. Yeah, I think you just kind of hinted at it. There are certain technologies that no matter what you do, it's not going to drive down the price. So just deploying more of it isn't going to lead to a learning curve that leads to less cost. But there's a lot of technologies where that's not the case. Famously, in wind and solar and storage, the deployment, the learning how to do this, had led to incredible drops in prices. There's reason to believe that at least parts of the hydrogen cycle, particularly the development of electrolyzers and other things, would be susceptible to that same, they're expensive at first, but you start making a lot of them, you have a lot of competition, you have an industry that develops, the price per unit will come way down. And it's in those cases where it makes sense to say, we would like to have this industry exist, we know we need to incentivize it initially, and then we can pull that incentive.
Representative Kraft.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. Yeah, I just want to put a pin in that for later discussions because, you know, this green hydrogen and things we could do, it could be a tremendous opportunity for us in many places, including the Iron Range and lots of other places around Minnesota. You talked about how what is driving costs primarily right now is the distribution system, right? If I looked at those things. And it's this black box. I was going to ask you why the difference between IOUs and co-ops, but I think we've kind of talked about that a bit. But this is more of a comment because I have a bill coming up before this committee next week that is getting squarely at this issue of distribution costs rising, how we make better use of it, how we make better use of it without having to build a ton more stuff, make better use quickly. and also how we generate more load growth on our existing set of wires. And I saw the graph that really grabbed me was one that showed load growth interacting with prices and costs, and the really substantial. So I just want to, you know, talk about that, point that out here, because I'll be coming back and we'll be referencing a lot of this information next week. But it's a real opportunity for us to do things that can impact costs and grid reliability and for Minnesota relatively rapidly. So I look forward to the discussion next week on virtual power plants. Thank you.
Next on the list is Representative Buck.
Thank you, Chair. I want to know, I heard you talk or mention briefly tribes. How have you worked with tribes and how's it going?
Commissioner Wyckoff.
I'm in Cherrycombe, Representative. We are actually very proud in DER for how much interaction we've had with tribal entities in Minnesota and how positive that has been. But I'm going to turn it to my colleague for a rundown on our programs.
Assistant Commissioner Polish, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Chair Acom and Representative, I'm Lissa Polish. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Federal and State Initiatives at the Minnesota Department of Commerce's Division of Energy Resources. Thank you so much for the question. As I think you are well aware, all state agencies in the state have formal consultation processes. Honestly, those are pretty fantastic experiences for us to get to go out and hear directly from tribal leadership what their challenges and issues are. We had a great consultation with Red Lake just a couple of weeks ago. It was largely about energy-related issues. There were other things that we talked about too, but energy is always high on the list. But we also have a Tribal Advocacy Council on Energy, also known as TACE, that you all authorized and helped provide funding for a couple of years ago, that has been really working closely with staff from tribes across the state. Upper Sioux isn't formally a part of it, but all of the rest of the 11 Native Nations are. And it's an opportunity for monthly conversations about energy issues that are coming forward. They also have quarterly meetings. They have different subcommittees around education and policy issues. And it has been quite fruitful in terms of having a conversation about what are the most pressing energy issues that tribal nations are tackling? What are the things that they're looking toward in terms of energy sovereignty and being able to advance their own goals for energy ownership and leadership, which they are already doing in many, many instances, but also thinking about how does workforce development work at a tribal level? How are the tribal nations helping spur that kind of workforce development? And then how are they thinking about affordability and directly for their members? What are the resources that they can commit and connect their members to and making sure that they have a level of autonomy that they're not energy burdened in the same ways that they have been? It has honestly, it's been a game changer for us. We get to have, you know, usually several times a month conversations with all of our tribal nation partners, and it has been extremely informative in terms of what we're thinking about.
Any follow-up, Representative Buck? And last but certainly not least, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Wyckoff. My question is on page number 8, where you're talking about electricity cost declining as a percentage of expenses or expenditures. So California, they were one of those really dark red states on the left. I know that Germany is about 50 cents a kilowatt. Can you tell us what you think the kilowatt cost for power will be as you go through here? I know we're doing projections, but what do you think is going to happen to the cost of power?
Commissioner Wyckoff.
So, Cherrycombe, Representative. I don't have on the top of my head, a particular target, but we can get you what the projections are translated into cost per kilowatt hour. I expect in nominal terms, just like everything else, the price of electricity will go up. In inflation-adjusted terms, as we transition, what our modeling has shown, as we transition to clean, we expect the force of the free fuel costs to be driving down electricity costs. Now, it's a balance of all of these forces. The main driver of California's increase has been fires.
if we suddenly start burning like California, we're going to have huge problems because those fires tend to be set by the electric system. So I'm sure they don't want to talk about it, but our main utility, IOU here, has had big problems in Texas with fires and has big legal issues there. That is one of the biggest drivers, is fire and hurricane risk. Hopefully we're at lower levels of both of those. If we start to be high hurricane risk in Minnesota, I'm really worried. But we get derechos. We didn't used to, really. We get polar vortexes like we didn't used to. We are going to have changing weather-driven electric costs, and I think they will be higher than people want to think. So I can get back to you with a translation of some of the projections we have to kilowatt hour, but I don't have it off the top of my head.
Any follow-up?
Yeah, Madam Chair. I think the big concern is though in Germany, I pay about 10 cents a kilowatt. I represent a lot of agriculture. Mm-hmm. You have a $1,000 light bill. In Germany, it's 50 cents a kilowatt. Trying a $5,000 light bill for a producer, not a good thing. The only other question I had is when you're looking at solar energy, can you tell me the amount of acres that are in that dot? Because it doesn't look like a lot compared to some of the numbers we talked about when we were originally looking at solar.
I don't.
Commissioner.
Chair Ackerman. Representative, I don't have that off the top of my head, but I can get it from our data scientist that made it. Yeah.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, and I think we're going to pass it off to co-chair.
So sounds good. Thank you. Thank you, co-chair Ackerman. Thank you, members, for your questions. And, just kind of maybe a comment to Professor Wyckoff. We talked a lot about, in your presentation included a lot about the potential changes from federal tax issues from the federal government, kind of with a tone of kind of what's been done to us. And, I would challenge everyone in this room, if those are the things that we're dealing with that are kind of, in a way out of our control, right, from the federal government, from a policy change, there are things within this room that we can change. Whether it be mandates that we're putting on purchasing, whether it be net metering reform, whether it be solar garden reform, whether it be SIP, inhalation of SIP spending, all the rest that are adding to the cost of energy, whether it's taxing energy, what those things are that we have within our control that can help balance out those potential changes that are out of our control. And, I would challenge us all to look and ask your utilities when it comes to that. And, one of my old high school shop teacher, Hannard Lean, who just passed away this summer, he said, Chris, many hands make light work. Now, when it comes to development of our utilities, Mr. Wyckoff's presentation talked a lot about that when it comes to load growth, when it comes to that change in dynamic of, we were held pretty solid as far as maintaining a lower energy for the last 15 or 20 years, that's going to drastically change. And, whether it's hands at the work site or electrons flowing through our lines, when it comes to transmission costs and when it comes to distribution primarily, we're seeing that as a large driver. That's labor, that's copper, that's transformers, that's the nitty-gritty of an expanded, complicated distribution system that is expensive to maintain. And the unique dynamic of that in a changing world of data centers and high, very pinpointed high consumption is that oftentimes those industrial users can help bear the cost on each electron sold. So that big piece of copper that comes in to a data center does not have near the amount of upkeep than a distributed system over thousands of acres or hundreds of square miles when it comes to the complexity of delivering that reliability. But those costs of selling each electron within a data center can get distributed and helped out and help, essentially subsidize some of the costs for a more complicated distribution system. So as we're debating that and we're encouraging that and we're creating policies around that, that there can be some positives to making many hands and many electrons make light work.
Chair Swedinski, it may surprise you, but I'm not going to argue with anything you said there.
I wasn't looking for an argument.
And I will maybe just end final comments before we switch over to the PUC.
Thank you very much for the presentation and the conversation around the table today. And I might look at our interest in the decisions being made at the federal level. I do think they're within and should be within all of our control. We are a democracy where we are states, and we pay a lot more into the federal government than we get out. And then when we're getting less out than was even promised, that's concerning. And so not only do we need to be concerned and advocate for our state, but we also need to be working on things here in Minnesota to make sure that energy continues to be affordable or becomes more affordable. So I thank you for your participation today, and I am going to turn the gavel over to my co-chair, who is going to switch us over to the next speaker.
Thank you. Can we get the folks from the PUC before us, and may you introduce yourself, and we look forward to hear from you. Would you guys please introduce yourself? And I believe, is there a new anyone new at the table that would like to especially introduce themselves from any new positions that might have occurred or anything?
Great. Thank you, Co-Chair Swidzinski, Co-Chair Akam, and members of the committee. My name is Sasha Bergman. I am the new Executive Secretary and Chief of Staff at the Public Utilities Commission. I'm, again, new, joined in the fall, but I'm very pleased to be here with all of you today. And I'm joined by Deputy Executive Secretary Mike Bull as well. We've got a few slides for you today. We're going to kind of tag team the presentation. So with that, we'll go ahead and get started. So some of the items that we want to cover today are providing an overview of the work of the Public Utilities Commission, talk a little bit about affordability, and then provide some legislative updates, which you can see there before you. You can see how we've been implementing some of the laws that the legislature has passed recently. So starting with the overview, the Public Utilities Commission is Minnesota's oldest regulatory body. The Minnesota legislature created the commission in the 1870s, to oversee and regulate services that are essential to the economic well-being of Minnesotans. And at that point in time, it was to regulate railroads and warehouses. Today, the mission of the PUC is to improve the lives of all Minnesotans by ensuring access to safe, reliable, and sustainable electric, natural gas, and landline telephone services at just and reasonable rates. The decisions of the agency impact the lives of Minnesotans in a variety of ways, whether that is the rates charged by for-profit utilities, the quality of electric, natural gas, or landline telephone service, or the quality of life for those who live nearby energy generation and transmission, just to name a few. The commission recognizes the importance of the decisions that it makes, and does so in adherence to the general and specific directives enacted by the legislature in Minnesota statutes, and you can see a few of those named on the slide in front of you. The PUC is a unique agency in state government with statutory authorities that are quasi-judicial, quasi-legislative, and administrative in nature. State statute vests the power of the agency in five commissioners who are appointed by the governor and approved by the Senate. The commission is an independent agency and is not a member of the governor's cabinet. So you can see on the slide before you the five commissioners currently serving. The governor selects the commission's chair, whose term is concurrent with that of the governor. The chair functions as the principal executive officer of the agency and has statutory authority to preside over the commission's meetings and, upon commission approval, gives staff direction through the executive secretary. Additionally, statutes give administrative authority of the agency to an executive secretary. Currently, the PUC is led by Chair Katie Sieben. We also have Vice Chair Commissioner Joe Sullivan, Commissioner Wikwan Ham, Commissioner Audrey Partridge, and Commissioner John Tuma. So we often refer to the Regulatory Compact, which is the foundational relationship and structure that's established in statute between the utilities, their customers, and the regulator. In exchange for an exclusive right to serve customers in a defined service territory for electric utilities or a defined service area for gas utilities, in exchange for that and an opportunity to recover costs and earn a reasonable rate of return, our utilities must provide safe, reliable service to all customers at just and reasonable rates, in addition to a host of other public interest requirements. The PUC's authority over utilities is primarily limited to for-profit companies that are owned by investors. The PUC does not regulate most aspects of municipal utilities or electric cooperative associations, but it may mediate or investigate complaints about them and advise on their long-term plans. Electric cooperative associations, however, may elect to be regulated by the PUC. So currently, the PUC regulates one electric cooperative association, Dakota Electric, which I know Dr. Wyckoff mentioned in the previous presentation, in addition to 8 investor-owned electric and natural gas utilities. So this slide highlights some of the primary areas of regulation for the PUC. The PUC's regulatory authority over electric and natural gas utilities includes setting utility standards and rates for investor-owned utilities. We also enforce, as mentioned, service quality standards, which means we hold utilities accountable for reliability and safety. Additionally, while the telecommunications landscape has changed significantly, the PUC maintains jurisdiction over landline telephone service to ensure that this critical communication link remains stable and accessible. And some additional areas of regulation. Perhaps our most forward-looking role is in overseeing comprehensive energy system planning. We don't just react to current needs. We're looking out, directing how the grid will evolve over the next 15 and 20 years and beyond. So that happens across 3 primary pillars. Generation planning. So we review integrated resource plans to select the best mix of energy resources, balancing affordability, reliability, and state carbon reduction and energy efficiency goals. Transmission and distribution, we oversee the necessary investments in the wires side of the business. So this helps ensure that the physical infrastructure from high voltage lines to the local meters at your homes is modernized and capable of handling new energy demands. And then in natural gas planning, we oversee resource planning for gas utilities to ensure safe and efficient supply as we navigate the transition to a cleaner energy future. The PUC also reviews requests by utilities and non-utilities that want to build large energy infrastructure projects, like high voltage transmission lines, power plants, solar farms, wind farms, storage facilities, and pipelines. And the PUC also actively participates in the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, so MISO, and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, proceedings as an individual member and as part of the organization of MISO states, as well as the Southwest Power Pool. And that work is really to promote state interests, promote and protect state interests, as well as influence regional transmission planning. And with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Bull for the next few slides.
Thank you, Sasha. And it's good to see everyone again. For the record, I'm Mike Bull. As Sasha mentioned, I'm the Deputy Executive Secretary at the Commission. And before I jump in on affordability, I just want to reiterate how special and unique an agency the Commission is, as Sasha just covered. I worked at the Commission early on in my career in a similar role to the one I'm in now, and then went off to work for a number of utilities, both investor-owned and cooperative utilities, and a number of clean energy organizations, and was leadership at the Department of Commerce in a previous administration. But I am honored and thrilled to be back at the Commission to finish out my career. The critical thing to know about the Commission is that you may not always get the decision you hope for on any individual docket, but you can be confident in the integrity of the decision, that it's well considered and based solely on the record and statutes. In my experience, because of the statutory construct governing the Commission actions, the Commission has consistently been one of the best utility commissions in the country. So with that commercial aside, I'll move on to our slides on how we approach affordability at the Commission. Affordability is always a priority for the Commission with regard to the utilities that we regulate. It's no surprise to any of you that costs are going up. Many of the factors driving these cost increases, as we've already discussed, are outside the control of the Commission, such as supply chain and wage inflation, increased wholesale commodity costs, loss of federal tax incentives and credits, as Dr. Wyckoff has covered, as well as the federal DOE decisions to extend operation of uneconomic coal plants, infrastructure that's at end of life and needs to be replaced, and the need to meet increasing energy demands of utility customers. Those are costs that are outside the commission's control for the most part, but to address the costs that are under the commission's control, affordability begins with the commission's oversight of utility costs long before they're included in customer bills. For us, affordability starts big picture with the various resource plan functions that we engage in that Sasha covered a few moments ago, size, type, timing of resource investments. We're working with the analysts at the Department of Commerce and multiple interveners. We scrutinize utility IRPs to determine the optimal portfolio of utility investments needed to meet customer demand, and comparing that with numerous alternatives until we right size and right cost those plans. Cost, reliability, and compliance with state law are the focus of our review at this stage. And then on to rate cases are the critical opportunity for the commission to police utility costs before they're charged to the customer. All the myriad and various costs of running a utility and providing service to customers, capital costs, operational costs, maintenance costs, are all comprehensively and painstakingly reviewed by the commission through excellent work of our technical analysts and those at the Department of Commerce, the Residential Utility Division at the Office of Attorney General, and a number of interveners. And through that work, utility rate requests are whittled down to the bare minimum necessary to operate the utility and provide safe, reliable service to Minnesota customers. So here's some of that's how we approach affordability. Here's some examples of that affordability work in action. These are decisions that the commission has made in proceedings to reduce costs to utility consumers. We've reduced utility rate requests by well over $1 billion over the past few years. These include reductions in rate requests by Xcel, CenterPoint, Minnesota Power, and Ottertail. We make critical decisions to reduce costs to customers in other proceedings, such as the decision in 2024 to reduce the forecasted cost of Xcel's Community Solar Garden Program by $687 million over 16 years. Another is the commission's decision in the Elite acquisition docket that just this last year will save Minnesota Power consumers approximately $200 million over the next few years. Some of those consumer benefits driven in that docket included $50 million in consumer bill credits, $10 million in home weatherization credits. The commission adopted a department recommendation to set aside $50 million to reduce the cost of the clean energy transition on the Minnesota Power system, $3.5 million in residential customer arrearage forgiveness. And all of these costs will be covered by the partners that have taken over ownership of Minnesota Power, and none of those will be charged to Minnesota Power customers. So that's affordability in action. This is affordability in outcome, and you've seen this slide already. Thanks, Pete, for the preview. So as he mentioned, recent study from the U.S. Department of Energy's Lawrence Berkeley National Lab shows Minnesota electric rates have declined about 1.5% relative to inflation between 2019 and 2024. And another metric. That's right. Preliminary information from the DOE's Energy Information Agency shows that Minnesota's residential electric rates are the fifth lowest in the country and lower than all of our neighboring states, and we were eighth lowest in 2024. So this is a consistent ranking for Minnesota and residential bills. But I think it's important to note, as Dr. Wyckoff did, as you can see from this slide, households are still hurting. With statewide past due accounts and disconnections both increasing over the past few years, reflecting the difficulty that some customers are having paying for their utility service. And to address this, the commission takes a multi-layered approach that combines strict regulation of utility costs that are within our control, as we've discussed,
oversight over utility bill assistance programs like the XL Power On program, Minnesota's CARE program, CenterPoint's gas affordability program, and then coordination with the Department of Commerce and other state and federal partners for home weatherization and bill paying assistance. So that's affordability from our perspective. I'll turn it back to Sasha to begin the legislative implementation updates.
Great. Thank you, Mike. So I'm going to cover the permitting reform law and where that sits today. I'll spend a couple of slides on it because it's been a major focus, I'd say, of the agency in doing implementation. So in 2024, the Minnesota legislature passed the Minnesota Energy Infrastructure Permitting Act. This law, which took effect July 1st of 2025, made a number of statutory changes in order to improve permitting efficiency, as well as meet timelines while preserving robust public input and environmental review. So the law basically categorized projects into two categories, standard review or major review. Standard review covers solar, wind, storage, and smaller scale high-voltage transmission lines. And major review is, I'm going to stumble over this, is mandatory for larger projects such as non-renewable facilities, 80 megawatts or greater, and high-voltage transmission lines over 300 kilovolts that exceed 30 miles or require more than 20% of new right-of-way. Mouthful. So to enhance collaboration, the Act transferred environmental review staff over from the Department of Commerce to the Public Utilities Commission. And prospective applicants must now coordinate early with state agencies, with local governments, with tribal governments, and they must submit a draft application for the commission staff to review before they formally file it. And lastly, applicants are the ones that now conduct the initial environmental review, which commission staff will review to determine if it addresses all of the issues that it's required to, and if it falls short, the staff at the commission will be producing a formal addendum to correct it. So this slide before you illustrates the major milestones for the standard review process, so not touching on the major review here in this graphic. Statute now mandates a commission decision within 6 months for standard review, and that's within 6 months of the determination of application completeness. And then in practice, you know, this will give us a 180-day window through which we may resolve simpler projects more quickly than that 6 months. Under the old statutes, similar alternative reviews at times stretched even beyond a year. And so, you know, we believe that the reforms enacted in the legislation will allow for still thorough but more efficient process. So just an update on where we're at. The first application under the new statute 216I was submitted in early November, and the commission determined that the project was complete on November 18th, so that triggers the six-month deadline. The docket number is listed there if anyone is interested, but we do, you know, we are moving quickly on it. The final public comment period closes this week for that project, and we expect that the administrative law judge's report will be issued by March 5th. After that point, the commission will, it'll be scheduled on an agenda meeting for a decision, but we do, you know, we do think it's entirely possible that will be even less than the 6 months that's required in law. To date, we have received 4 applications under the new law, so I note that the slide is a little bit, there's a typo, it should say 4 total applications on the second bullet point, not 4 other. But we've received 4 applications under the 216I, and all 4 of them are under standard review. We have not yet received an application falling under the major review category, and we will, you know, certainly look forward to keeping this committee apprised as that implementation continues. Back to Mr. Bell.
So with regard to data center tariffs, as Dr. Wyckoff mentioned, nation-leading legislation enacted last session requires the commission to define a very large customer class. That's what the statute refers to, how the statute refers to data centers for each public utility in Minnesota, and to ensure that all costs associated with that customer class will be paid for by that customer class and not charged to any other customers. No cost should spill over into non-data center customers. I say this is nation-leading because a number of states have followed what you all did last session by enacting or adopting similar restrictions on cost allocation. We have a docket ongoing for Xcel Energy to define this very large customer class and the tariffs that goes along with it. We'll expect filings from Minnesota Power and Otter Tail in the next couple weeks. But I'll just mention these are frameworks for how costs will be allocated between data center customers and non-data center customers. The actual terms and conditions between a utility and a data center will be dealt with in separate subsequent filings called electric service agreements, and we don't currently have any of those pending before the commission.
Sure. If you just want to repeat that for a second. So you don't currently have any applications for any signed contracts laying before the commission? Okay.
Mr. Co-Chair, that's correct. Next, I want to talk with you about a new position that was in our Consumer Affairs Office that was created in 2024, tasked with assisting applicants who are seeking to interconnect small solar projects to utility distribution systems. The person in this position, a woman named Erin Speltz, who's terrific, helps mediate consumer issues with the investor-owned electric utilities, handling issues like interconnection disputes, reviewing utility policies to clarify and avoid disputes, and convening stakeholder groups to improve understanding and communication of interconnection processes. This position is funded by a surcharge on each interconnection application that's filed with the utility. And something to note, the 2024 legislation limited the commission to one person for this role, one position, and Erin has handled 149 cases last year. The next item I wanted to brief you on is legislation also passed in 2024 that required us to convene stakeholders for a thermal energy network deployment work group. Thermal energy networks, or TENs, are efficient but relatively expensive systems that provide space heating, cooling, and water heating to multiple buildings through a shared thermal loop. The charge to the commission, to the work group, was to examine the potential regulatory barriers for regulated gas utilities to deploy TENs and to identify potential barriers to that deployment, and we provided those stakeholder recommendations to you in a report in mid-December last year. Another item, you guys were very busy in 2024. Another item also passed in 2024 was directing the electric utilities to evaluate the cost and feasibility of grid-enhancing technologies on their transmission systems to alleviate congestion. GETs are hardware and software technologies that allowed for expanded capacity and flexibility of an existing transmission network. I should note that our electric utilities had already been planning for and deploying GETS technologies, but the 2024 legislation really stepped that up by requiring the electric utilities that own significant transmission to incorporate and evaluate GETS projects in the biennial transmission plan they filed with the commission last November, and to continue to evaluate those projects and that biennial transmission plan that, not surprisingly, comes every 2 years. That's why it's called a biennial transmission plan. And we'll take the first round of GETS projects up in late spring. Another piece of legislation in 2024 directed the commission to adopt statewide standards governing the sharing of the cost of planning and upgrading congested and constrained locations on utility distribution systems in order to allow for the interconnection of those distributed projects like solar to the distribution system. We had, I think you're well aware, or many of you are, that we had significant congestion on the Xcel system that has made it difficult for a number of projects to be interconnected. But we expect to see as these dockets move forward. One was decided in September of 25. The other will be decided by the end of February. So we expect to see some easing of that congestion that we've seen on the Xcel system going forward. I also wanted to highlight legislation that was added to provide additional protections to renters who receive utility bills through a landlord or third-party rebilling company. Prior to this, renters did not have the protections that are allowed utility customers, such as utility shutoff, protections from utility shutoff under the cold weather rule, the ability to call our consumer affairs office with complaints, to have complaints mediated with the utility that serves them. Those folks, this consumer affairs office, those are they are heroes. Every day they're working to manage that difficult interaction between a customer who is facing maybe shutoff and the utility that may not really know what it's why it's doing what it's doing. And so these folks are I get emotional, excuse me, but they do great work. And I also wanted to flag them for you. They can help you if you have constituent questions about utility service. Make sure you think about referring them down to our consumer affairs office. We'll be able to help them. So now renters have the same ability to do this as before. And finally, two other pieces of legislation that were enacted in previous years. The legislature enacted the Natural Gas Innovation Act in 2021 in the wake of Winter Storm Uri to allow natural gas utilities to explore and demonstrate innovative ways to meet their needs of their customers through the use of biofuels like renewable natural gas and hydrogen, thermal energy networks, as we've discussed, electrification, enhanced energy efficiency, and other means. CenterPoint's initial NGIA plan was approved by the Commission in July of 2024. XL's first plan was approved by the Commission in February 2025. Note that these plans are voluntary. The NGIA doesn't require that they file these plans. These utilities are stepping up in order to innovate for how they might meet the needs of their customers. And then finally, I wanted to highlight the Commission's work to implement the carbon-free standard that we enacted was in 2023. That legislation, the 100% by 2040 that Dr. Wyckoff referenced, directed the Commission to issue orders necessary for implementing the CFS. Since the bill passed, the Commission has been taking comments from utilities and stakeholders and issuing guidance as directed by the legislation on a series of implementation issues. As you can see here, the Commission has issued several rounds of guidance under the law and expect to complete that guidance by mid-year this year. And throughout these CFS orders, it's fair to say the Commission has been working to identify and issue practical least cost guidance consistent with the statute to ensure successful implementation of the carbon-free standard, which is our charge. And in closing.
All right. Thank you. So just as we close here, wanted to provide you all with a little bit of information about how you can stay informed about the work that the Commission does. We've got a great monthly newsletter that includes recent decisions, information about recent decisions, as well as, you know, kind of what's coming up on the calendar. You can attend a public meeting either virtually or in person. We've got the link on there for you. The Commission has an X and a LinkedIn accounts where we are posting information through those venues. And then importantly, I think, in particular for your constituents, the utility service or billing assistance that Mr. Bull was touching on, I mean, really the good work of our consumer affairs office, you know, really trying to make a difference for Minnesotans. And so the ways that you can reach them are with the phone number listed there as well as the email address. So I will leave it there, and Mr. Bull or I will be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you. Just to kind of go back to your slide on 24, just a general question kind of on that ombudsman position. So you just mentioned that there's 149 cases that the person helped out with.
Yep.
You said there was one decision in September and another one that's upcoming.
Oh.
So I was just trying to clarify that, those numbers, and then just kind of what was the solution to that?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think maybe combine two things. So this ombudsperson mediates complaints and helps folks who want to interconnect to the distribution system. The other slide had to do with we have two dockets ongoing about how utilities are planning for building out their distribution systems to relieve congestion on the distribution system for solar interconnection. So those two dockets, that September 2025 and the one coming up in February, had to do with the building, the planning for building and paying for that infrastructure that's necessary for those solar interconnections. So those two functions are separate.
Sounds good. Thank you. All right, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. I was wondering if you all could provide some oversight on how the PUC reviews distribution plans. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of transparency in that process, and you know, Department of Commerce just showed us how distribution costs keep going up, and they certainly are in my district, and I'm just trying to understand better what that looks like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mr. Bolt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hollins. We have periodic filings by utilities, integrated distribution plans that they file with the commission. They go through the regular commission process of where the Department of Commerce will dig in and try to gather additional information from the utilities. Stakeholders and interveners will do the same. And so through that notice and comment period is that process is how that the details of and the costs associated with those integrated distribution plans, how that gets exposed. And then all of that happens, and then it comes to the commission for a decision. We have a series of recommendations that the department and stakeholders, interveners, have developed for the commission to act on those plans. So they may approve or modify the plan in addition adopting a series of decision options that stakeholders, interveners have proposed.
Representative Hollins, follow up. We have 10 minutes till we're done.
I know. I'm sorry. Yeah, I will follow up with you individually because I have a lot more follow-up questions.
Sure.
The other question I wanted to ask, is there any PUCs in the country that do regulate cell phones? Because you mentioned being in charge of landlines still, but not cell phones?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Bull.
Representative Hollings, no. Those are Federal Communication Commission. Those are federal, overseen by the Federal Communication Commission.
Representative Hollins?
I just want the record to reflect that I would rather the PUC be in charge of cell phones, but thank you.
Except when you cross state lines, that might be a problem. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Ms. Bergman, to the committee. And
I'll echo that.
My question, welcome also, Mr. Bull. You mentioned that what you do, what the PUC does, is whittle down requests to the bare minimum. And my understanding of this is that these are generally, you know, capital requests whittled down, and then you allow a certain return on equity, and that's how, you know, the eventual rate case is approved. So the return on equity that is given to a utility is obviously a key piece of that. How do you calculate what is an acceptable return on equity?
Mr. Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was hoping Sasha would take the notes. So this is a highly technical area and mostly beyond my ken. My wife doesn't let me near the checkbook, so this is not an area that I'm all that familiar with. But I will tell you what I do know. So. For every rate case, a utility will propose rate case, it'll propose a return on equity, and this is the return on the capital that its shareholders are putting to work on behalf of the public interest. They deserve some return for that investment. The department will take a first swing at how to look at that. Return on equity, and they'll provide, they'll do some modeling, and they'll provide a bound of what's acceptable, you know, low and a high, and they'll make a recommendation. Interveners like the Office of Attorney General will also do that, and CUB, the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota, will get involved and make recommendations on that. For most rate cases that come before the commission, This item is included in a settlement that the department will bring to the commission, and so we don't get to decide too much in terms of what decision, what rate of return will be, except approving that settlement. When a rate case comes to the commission that's not settled, we have a history, and we tend to be in the of the, if you break the states up into tiers of high ROE to low ROE, we're in that sort of the lower middle fourth tier. We tend to approve rate of returns that are in that we're lower than the national average, but we're not the lowest.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bowles, so I'm interested in, you talked about modeling, and then you said in the lower tier.
Yeah.
Is that a goal? Is what other people are getting for ROEs in other parts of the country, is that a factor, and how much of a factor is that in the models you have?
Yeah,
Secretary Bull.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative Kraft, that's a great question. What in that modeling that the department will do, they'll look at proxy utilities, so utilities that are similar to the one that's bringing us that rate case, and they'll look at what ROEs have been allowed for those other utilities, what the risk associated with that utility. Like, for example, Minnesota Power in the past has been Minnesota's most risky utility because of the cyclical nature of their taconite customers, and they come in and out of the system. So they tend to be looped in with more risky utilities, and they usually get a higher return from us. The XL has a much more stable customer base, as well as a number of items that allow them to a more stable revenue through riders and other true-up mechanisms. So they tend to come in, we tend to approve lower ROEs for them, well below the national average, much to their chagrin. But I want to say there's a lot of modeling, there's a lot of technical work that goes on. It also is a matter of, there is some art to it, because the idea is you want to find that sweet spot of low enough that you're not overburdening the utilities customers, but a little bit high enough that they're still attracting that capital from shareholders.
All right, thank you. All right, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be quick. Thanks for your presentation. You talked about affordability. I didn't hear any mention on reliability. Maybe that's not in your wheelhouse, but where I live on the prairie, when it's 25 below zero, I want my electricity to work. And I have nothing against wind and solar, but they don't work all the time. There needs to be some kind of backup, and battery, after 4 hours, it's not there yet. So is there a value you place on reliability when you figure these things? And because it is important to everybody.
Secretary Bergman or Bull, you guys, I'll let you guys choose who talks.
No, I can just start. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. Reliability is tremendously important. That is something that is a central focus of the commission. I'm not sure I do, as a new person here, I want to make sure I'm accurately and completely answering questions. So I'll see if Mr. Bull has anything more specific that you would want to touch on with regard to the commission's work.
Yeah, I think I don't want to leave you with the impression that reliability is not important. I want to, because affordability has been such a core conversation that's happening probably in all your districts with all your constituents, we wanted to touch that on that. But reliability is sort of at the heart of the, if the energy isn't being delivered to the utility customer, then nothing else matters. The affordability of service, the customer service, none of that else matters unless those electrons or those therms of gas can be delivered to a customer. So it is sort of core function, and it's the key element, it's a key element in all these planning processes that we undergo, the generation resource planning, the transmission planning,
the distribution planning and the gas resource planning. Reliability of service is sort of the table stakes for that planning, and then we try to figure out what's the least cost way to deliver that those resources to customers. So that's where affordability gets.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. So does it concern you, and maybe this isn't a fair question, but as we shut down coal plants, for example, are we replacing that baseload power quickly enough to keep that reliability where it needs to be?
Mr. Bowl, in 5 seconds, you can answer that easy question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's a key question. One of the things that there's a recent study by the National Energy Reliability Corporation, NERC, that shows a high risk of shutdowns or blackouts in the Midwest region of the country. Unfortunately, they left out of that analysis about 7 gigawatts of resource that MISO is actively working to bring online. Many of those gigawatts are gas plants to replace coal plants. So I don't think we have a reliability problem in the Midwest or in Minnesota. As a matter of fact, I'd say if every other state in the Midwest had the resource planning process that Minnesota does, there would be no concern about reliability in the Midwest.
Representative Jones.
Sorry, I didn't think you were going to get to me. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Bull. I had a question about the ombudsman. I was just wondering if you could dive a little bit more on how do stakeholders think it's going.
Mr. Bull.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jones. My understanding is stakeholders think it's going well, that they and there may be an interest in expanding that function at the commission. As I mentioned, it's limited to one position, so there may be interest in expanding that work amongst the stakeholders who are served by that ombudsperson. That's a hard word to say.
All right. Thank you very much. With that, we are adjourned.